Okay, Bill, talking about the neoprene plant in Louisville, as we were earlier, the government took that over during the war.
Yeah.
And we operated it.
Yes,
the government
we operated
bought it back.
Yeah, they took over our plant and added three more to it. In other words, it turned out 40,000 instead of 10.
Yeah. Okay. Were you involved at all in the government rubber project during the war?
No.
Or did DuPont stay purposely aloof from that?
Well, I had nothing to do with it in the general. We were involved, of course, with the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the Rubber Commission, which they worked very closely with them with the establishing the plant and the money and all contracts and the development of the relations between the government and ourselves. But that was... But as far as the rubber allocations of rubber itself, no.
I'll see, in 1952, you went on the, for a time, on the Office of Price Stabilization.
Oh, yeah, Mike, what was his name? He was had been mayor of Toledo. Mike DeSalles was the head of the Office of Price Administration, OPA. Mm-hmm. And a number of people from industry had been asked, I guess the rubber chemical manufacturing organization had been asked to supply some men to go down there, head up various divisions in the pricing of chemicals. And I had was given the assigned to the pricing of aliphatic chemicals.
Right. Okay, yeah, we have a copy of, that was after Galbraith had left and so on, right? So you didn't run into him?
Never. The only one of any political importance that I had to do it with was Mike DeSalles.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've indicated, alluded earlier, the fact that you did a lot of work with the ASTM.
Oh, yes.
Standards and so on. That was an important contribution.
Well, I did a lot of work with them. I enjoyed it. Standardization of.
You were 50 years with the American Chemical Society. Yes. Any other professional organizations that you were particularly active in?
No, I think the ASTM was and the ACS were the only two that I was ever much interested in.
So your contributions to the rubber business and DuPont are a large number of years involved in the marketing and product quality and that sort of thing.
That's right.
Anything that really stands out in your mind about this part of your career?
No, because I loved people. And I love to mingle with people and to be with people. And I think that one of the biggest contributions that I had with our particular organization was holding it all together through thick and thin. There was some of the times that some of the boys got terribly discouraged or somebody got their nose out of joint or... personnel things that I enjoyed very much, and I think I did have a large contribution to our organization in making a team out of it and making the thing gel, making it work, keeping the gears lubricated and meshed. And then to carry that one step further, I think that's what happened in my work with ASTM, and as closest it worked with the ASE. And the ASME, as a matter of fact, to get the two together instead of sitting across the table and like two cats ready to spring at each other, get them where they're working together. And I think we accomplished a great deal in that respect and made a lot of progress.
Talking about people, you worked with a large number of people, some of whom I'm very curious about and other people are. J. Warren Kinsman.
Yeah, well, the Warren hired me.
Yes, I remember now. He had, as I recall, no real technical background in his education.
I think he had the same kind of. He might have had. He went to. He might have had some. He went to the college at Wesley in Middletown, Connecticut.
Oh, he did.
And I think he took a liberal arts course. Mm-hmm.
He
was a salesman through and through.
Yeah, but he ended up
He was one of the vice presidents.
Plant manager and finally vice president.
Yeah, I don't remember much about his functions or his accomplishments as a plant manager.
He got a lot of visibility as a spokesman.
He was that. He was a. Well, you have to have a certain amount of egotism to go through things like he was a salesman, put it that way.
Okay, I guess he struck me when I knew him from a distance as a politician.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, that's right. He was all that.
Similar.
Yeah, I liked Warren very much.
Did you have close dealings with him or just?
Well, I wouldn't say they were close. I felt close to him, mm-hmm. and we were always very friendly, and my wife was friendly with he and his wife. We were good friends, put it that way.
Jack Daly.
Oh, Jack. I worked for Jack. Jack was a straight shooter. I liked Jack very much. Mm-hmm. He was like old Buck Harrington. He was the first top boss that I had when I first came here. He was a kind of a grumpy, gruff Southern little fellow, but He liked him. He was a square shooter. That's the way with Jack. Jack was a square shooter. He could be tough at times, but he was demanding, as he should be, a general manager.
The other name that you mentioned was Buck Harrington?
Buck Harrington.
Harrington.
He was Willis Harrington. Willis F. Harrington. He was general manager of Orchem when I came to work.
I see.
And then he went upstairs, and Ed Robinson took his place.
I knew.
Then Jack Daly came in.
Daly seemed sort of a rough character to me. He gave Roy Arnsperger was research director research director for Orchem, and the first year he was research director, he asked Daly to address as a scientific staff at the annual meeting they had.
Well, Jack was a little rough, but. He was absolute square shooter.
Yeah. Well, I don't doubt that.
He always knew where you stood with Jack. He got
I just remember that he gave a very downbeat kind of lecture about he wasn't sure about the future of the punk company. He wasn't sure the people were getting now were as good as they were when he came in. And was
with Jack?
Yeah. Well, he was grousing about things that people, first question they asked was, are your labs air conditioned and what are your fringe benefits? And he didn't think this was the kind of question he'd like to hear asked, I guess. Arnold Collins, of course.
Yes, he worked with Carruthers, and he was the guy that he made the first chloroprene and left it in the test tube and found the gum there in the morning.
Was he? He was from Columbia, I believe.
I'm not certain.
I'm sure of that. That was. Did you think him to be a particularly brilliant fellow, or just?
Well, I had no real way to evaluate with him. Nice as ever, chappy. He wasn't a particularly happy disposition, but. I knew Arnold Collins and have no reason to really to evaluate him in any way at all.
He was very modest. I remember having talked with him.
He would strike you as being a very modest person, unassertive.
Yeah. You must have met Wallace Carruthers at least.
Yes, I met him a number of times. And I liked the man very much. In fact, I knew him a little bit socially when he lived out there with two or three other men, that little house. I forgot Colonel somebody's house out there. And we used to go out there, particularly in the wintertime, do a little skiing around. Yeah, Wallace Carruthers was an awful nice fellow. He told the poor devil had awful migraine headaches. And I think that's what happened to him. Just couldn't take it anymore.
He had a long-standing problem with depression.
There was some disagreement or disappointment in the way research was going. He wanted to keep it pure research, and there was a great demand from upstairs to get your product and get back into production.
That's pertinent, because that brings up some thoughts about Stein and Bolton.
Yeah.
I've heard from other people who were in the chemical department in the 30s when Bolton took over that there was a definite change.
Well, he was all for pushing research into dollar sales.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Stein was at the...
And I think that bothered Carruthers a great deal.
Yeah, I see. Well, I think... do you think that may have affected Carruthers then?
Well, I think it was one that plus his migraine headaches and maybe the pressure to get stuff out of research and get it into commercial production.
Julius Newland, did you know him?
Well, I wouldn't say I know him. I've met him many times. He was an interesting character. He was a great botanist.
Yes.
He used to like to come down and spend weekends, and he was quite a pal of Calcutt's. Calcutt was director of the Jackson Lab. And the two of them would spend their weekends roaming around the pines of Jersey.
Oh, the Pine Barrens.
Yeah, up there. And he was a botanist.
I found Father Newland listed on one of the chemical department organization charts in about the year. I don't remember. Did you remember that he had been here?
He used to come quite frequently, but as a consultant.
As a consultant.
Yeah.
But he was actually listed on the staff, not as a consultant that particular
time. I don't know about that. I always thought he was...
He'd spent maybe a few months here.
I thought he... Well, he... I don't ever remember his staying for any extensive periods. He may have, but I remember him as coming quite frequently and staying weekends.
I'd never been able to confirm that with anybody else. I thought maybe you knew.
He was a very pleasant fellow. I liked he and his old pipe.
Oh.
I always picture him with his pipe.
Is that right? Now, you said elsewhere, I think you told John Smith that you made some neoprene desk holders for the Pope and for Father Newland, Bill Calcutt, and yourself.
Yeah.
Is that right? Newland was going over to visit the
Pope. That's right. That's right.
Are any of these pen holders still in existence?
I think that I sent mine over to Hagley.
Uh-huh.
I think they have it.
Yeah.
It was around, about so thick, black, and with a pen holder molded into it when it was made. You stick a pen in it.
Interesting.
I believe that's over at Hagley.
Yeah. They ought to treasure that if they have it. Well, you probably knew some DuPont presidents and chief executives in some way.
Well, the one that I knew at all was Lamont DuPont.
And you indicated in your earlier interview that he was strongly supportive of the...
Oh, yeah, he supported research and supported the kind of work that we were doing, the application work. I remember his sitting on the corner of my desk as I was hitting and saying, quizzing me about neoprene, this is early days. He says, "Have we even got a one shot in a thousand? I'm going to support it if you think it looks like it had any chance at all, because we can take what if this is a start and we can spend money to develop it." And that was very encouraging.
Walter Carpenter, did you...
Very personable man.
Uh-huh.
Very personable man. Made you feel entirely at ease when he'd call you up in his office. You just relax. First thing you do is hand you a cigarette or a cigar and just relax. And I could talk to him just like I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was apparently much involved at the start of the war in the question of how much expansion you're going to have in neoprene and
very much.
He had some reservations about, in fact, he was against it, I think.
Well, I didn't have that part of it. I would be more technical when he would ask me what I thought about the quality, what are the prospects of putting the into the field, and where could it be used, things and subjects of that sort. But beyond that, I had nothing.
Questions of investment policies.
No, investment policies and all that. That was
plant size and.
No, that would be Ed Robinson.
You were certainly involved, probably in. Weren't you involved in some way in market estimates, or did you just?
Oh yeah, well we all yes, sure, forecasting and estimates. Yeah, yes indeed.
Do you have any dealings with Crawford Greenwalt?
Very few, just casual. No. No.
And Pierre DuPont and Irene DuPont had.
Well, I didn't know those men at all. They were just names. Saw them, knew who they were, but I never had any close relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That is with the old Pete and the old Pierre and Irene.
You mentioned Clifford Sanderson earlier.
Well, Cliff Sanderson was one of us three at Fisk.
Ah, I see. This was.
And he was the senior of the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
And when Fisk was taken over by U.S., Cliff left and went with Goodyear.
Uh-huh.
And the other fellow, Joe Partenheimer, he went with. Standard Oil in New Jersey, and headed up Atlas Group, Atlas Tires, Atlas Automobile Accessories, and he was with them until he retired. He's still living.
Yes, you had a clipping. I guess that's the reason you had a clipping. Apparently from Artis's Worcester Polytech bulletin or journal about Sanderson.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I...
Yeah, well, Cliff was a very close friend of mine.
Mm-hmm. Your association continued then through the rubber division or just personally?
With Cliff?
Cliff.
Well, of course, he was a senior of us three kids at Fisk.
Yeah.
And I always kept in contact with him socially.
Yeah. Herbert Walker.
Herb Walker?
Herb Walker, yeah. Well,
Herb is one of the boys over at Jackson Lab. Did you know him?
Oh, yes. I know him. In fact, he was finishing his volume on the chemistry and technology of neoprene and when I arrived. And one of the first things they did to all of the new people coming in was to say, go in and talk to Herb Walker and find out from him what you ought to know. it was interesting.
Yes, I knew Herb.
He told me a lot of tales about the. He's a very capable man, I think. I was looking
Herb, yes, he was.
Reports and patents and
he's a pretty good fellow.
Yeah. You had mentioned Dr. Ira Williams, so I guess we'll.
Ira Williams was a real original man, original thinker. Original door. He was the most fertile mind. This is aside from the whole thing, but Ira came, he went over to Woodstown, bought himself a house, and he liked boxwood, so he had a row of boxwood on either side of his sidewalk going into his house. The dogs was coming down the street, would turn up on the boxwood down at the end, and it would burn them. And I used to go over to see Ira quite often. I noticed the boxwood looked pretty good. I said, what'd you do with this? He said, I know how to fix these dogs and save my boxwood. He said, I got myself a little dachshund and I got a muzzle. And I shot at the darning needle at the end of that muzzle. And he says, if the dogs would come down the street to visit, he'd go out to and greet the other dogs. And they'd take off. So they had no more trouble.
I thought you were going to tell me he had a chemical.
No. He made most all of his own equipment. He was unique.
What happened to him?
He left and went with the J.M. Huber Colors and Carbon Black people. He went down to Borger, Texas, headed up their research. I wouldn't want this in this part of it here about him.
Okay, let's...
That's an incident that I wouldn't want in the tape.
Well, it's not. I put it on the pause. Yeah. But the gist of it is that he did go down to Texas and he died a few years later. Ernest R. Bridgewater was your boss, I guess. And what was his background?
He went to Tech. I always call it a Boston Tech, MIT, mm-hmm. but he didn't graduate. I think he left during the war, and as I remember, went to work in the Bureau of Standards with Lewis, and they worked on gas. He went with Goodrich, and it was from Goodrich that I have a hunch that Kinsman hired him from Goodrich.
Vic Cosler was...
Vic was a character. That's old Vic there standing up back there. Vic was a character. He was a very competent man. He had been in Goodrich for years. And then he went to Cooper Hewitt, I think it was, as a technical superintendent of their plant in mechanical rubber goods. And he was brought into our group to head up what we call indirect selling. That is to go out and show a prospective customer how, by using our product, he could substitute it for something else or make a new one that was far better than anything in the field, and therefore he'd have a lucrative business. And that was cost for it. He was very good at that, an exceptionally good man. And he stayed until he retired. Had he retired out before he just dropped dead?
He retired.
I think so.
He died of heart.
Bert Lattimore.
Bert is a publicity man, and very, very good man. He's still doing some of that publicity work. He's retired. Lives in Port St. Lucie in Florida.
You mentioned in one of your, I guess it was in your talk at Montreal, you mentioned Mel Lerner of Rubber Age.
Yeah, well, Mel, he was a good friend of ours, put it that way. And he was always receptive to anything that was new. And he gave us a lot of publicity about neoprene.
You know, was he a technical man or a writer?
He was the editor of the Rubber Age. I think he had some technology background.
And you mentioned also Pete Pino of Rubber World.
Well, Pinto, same sort of a thing.
I worked with Howard Starkweather Jr., so I'm particularly interested in Howard Starkweather Sr.
Howard Starkweather Sr. was a very fine man. He was a Quaker, and true to Quaker, he was a very plain sort of person, but as honest as the day is long, his word was, nothing was stronger than his word for anything. He was a very high principled person. He was very strict. He was in his morals, and he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, but still was liked by everybody.
He became
a very competent man. He's a graduate of Harvard, a PhD at Harvard.
Sam Lerner, I suppose you knew.
Oh, I knew Sam. Yeah, I knew Sam when he was in Short Pants. That's not literally true, but I know when he first came to work and worked in Jackson, worked in Tech Lab in the dye end of it.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
He lives out of the Quaker place.
Oh, Sam, he's... Sam isn't a Quaker.
Huh?
Sam's not a Quaker.
No, but he lives out of the...
Oh, he does live now. He lives at... No, he lives over here. No. I call it Turkey Coop House, Farm, Turkey Ranch place, but...
I think I know where...
It's out near Hokesson.
Yeah, okay. Harold Ellie was research director when I came.
Harold Ellie is one of my very closest friends.
Uh-huh.
So anything, I might be biased. I liked Harold Ellie. He's a very fine man, very much of a gentleman, and very competent, I thought.
Yes. He musician too, as I recall.
Oh yes, he was a beautiful pianist and a very good organist. His recreation used to be go over to Will Raskob's place, where Raskob had a pipe organ in his music conservatory, and he used to go over there Saturdays and play that organ. That was his recreation.
Let's see, you mentioned E.G. Robinson has been mentioned earlier, but I don't know.
He was our general manager. He was Swarthmore graduate and had been at the experimental station in the early days.
And Frederick B. Downing, I remember. He was.
Oh, Fred Downing. Fred had a lot to do with early days in neoprene.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
I'd associated him more with tetraethyl lead.
Well, he went from tetraethyl lead. He came over and got into the. I think he was section leader or group leader under which the work on neoprene was done at the Jackson Laboratory. Fritz Downing, we called him.
Yeah, Fritz.
Yeah.
He preferred that. In fact, I was saying earlier. It was all first names over there at Jackson.
Always.
In fact, I was warned when I arrived, do not call Mr. Tinker Doctor.
No.
John Tinker.
John. John Tinker.
I don't know. I don't know whether the people that without the PhDs were particularly conscious of it or not. There were quite a few people around who did very well without PhDs in the company.
Sure. And John is one of them.
Yeah. He's in one of the retirement pictures that you, retirement party pictures you gave me.
Would be,
Do you remember him? Of course, he was biochemistry mainly, wasn't he?
John?
Yeah.
Oh. He came from Newport, so he must have been.
Yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
Of course, Nick Carter.
Well, Nick, of course, he grew up in Jackson Lab, and Nick was pretty good. And he was an acetylene man, really. I always thought of him as being one of the good acetylene chemists.
Was he responsible in some way for the monovalent acetylene plant or something at the at Chambers Works?
Well, I don't know if he was responsible for it, but he was... very, very much tied up with it.
The reason I was asking, I can remember.
I think on the design end of it, Freddie Mitchell probably was had more to do with it than that.
At Carter's retirement party, they were ribbing him this various things, and one of the things they showed us as his accomplishments was a building on fire. All the older people laughed, and I didn't understand what that was about. It had to do with the.
He was involved, of course. That was monovinyl acetylene that got loose. That fire. I always think of Herb Walker. He had monovital acetylene. He put it aside. Next morning he came in, he had a pencil and stuck it in the test tube, and bang, it went, you know. Burned his face, burned his eyelids off, burned his hair off.
I can remember a story about somebody, maybe you know to whom this, somebody who had a little ball, presumably had a little ball of, and I thought it was a divinyl acetylene polymer or something, sitting on his desk.
Well, they wouldn't have been fooling around with a ball of that, unless they had a ball of
it. This little ball of rubber-like material spontaneously paralyzed one day. Do you recall any stories like that?
It did what?
It paralyzed, you know, just spontaneously paralyzed or burned. Just took.
Well, pyrolyzed.
Pyrolyzed,
yes. The gel would. Yes, I remember. Monovinyl acetylene, a divinyl acetylene, would rapidly, very rapidly, within a matter of hour, many minutes, would form a peroxide. And that peroxide was a gel. And as you went through that stage, if you disturbed it, you were in trouble. That was in the test tube, and Herb just had to touch it with a pencil. I remember another time, when it was fully polymerized, was the most as inert as silica. We thought we want to be able to coat chemical drums because it's absolutely inert. And one of the experiments was they covered, they painted this on the rubber laboratory table as a table cover over, say, over soapstone. They come in the morning and somebody dropped a hammer or pliers or something on it.